Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.
You and I both know this. When money and mental health collide, it's not just your bank balance that gets hurt. Your soul often is too. And there's no one better to guide us through that complex terrain than Vanyile Magwagwa. She's not just a finance coach. She's the money healer, the woman who paid off 60,000 US dollars in debt, rebuilt herself with radical intention, and turned that healing into a movement. Through Wealthy Money, her books, and her podcast Money Magic and The Property Magicians, she helps women of color transform their money narratives and restore their emotional and financial sovereignty. In this conversation, as it is Personal Finance Monday, I really want to talk more than strategy. I want this to be a sanctuary. How do we protect our peace when our financial wounds run deep? How do we heal the ancestral stories that still shape our spending, our stress, and our survival? So Vanyile is not going to talk numbers with us tonight. She's going to give us the courage to feel, to forgive, to reimagine a life where our money choices are anchored in wholeness and not wounds. So if you've ever felt anxious pulling up your bank balance, or ashamed hiding financial stress behind strong woman energy or strong man energy, because anyone could be listening to this conversation, this is one that is really designed for you. Vanyile, hello.
Hi, Mpumi. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm good. Enjoying the spring weather.
At the ocean.
No. Listen, Cape Town, we had a proper winter. People in Joburg would be crying about winter here and there, the cold here and there. We had like 7 degrees, 8 degrees all
crazy.
Day long, every day.
That
oh my God,
crazy.
It was so cold.
Asking. But it's spring now, just about to be summer, and people are going to flock Cape Town.
I know, it's already started, hey? I've already been like, what the hell?
Leave the people alone. Leave the people alone. Let's get into our conversation. And I really want us to start at speaking about healing before hustle. Now, your journey began with a breakdown, a bank balance you couldn't face. Tell me how that despair became your turning point.
I mean, wow. The interesting thing about turning points, right, is that you, and I really want to say this for someone that's like, gosh, I've been at this for like a year and it's not moving, is that the turning point doesn't feel like a turning point. It just feels like how.
This is so true.
For 2 to 3 years, it just felt like, oh my gosh, I'm treading water. And then when the shift happened, I mean, like most people got to know about me in the midst of the shift. And then it was just beautiful and being able to talk about it, right? But at the time, the despair just felt hard. I didn't know it at the time, but my turning point was actually my panic attacks and my depression. You know, the depression, the panic attacks, I keep saying to people, like, everything that I have done in my life has come from that point on, you know? It came from the panic attacks. It came from the depression. So for me, it was just not being able to get out of bed for about 2 years, like getting up, doing the motions. Yeah, but like for most days in those 2 years, in 2009 and 2010, most days I got up. But I have this amazing friend, and Elise, we're still friends. And then another friend, she's Taiwanese, Cha Chu. They would come over to me in Boston, and Cha Chu would come in the mornings and chant with me and just inspire me. And she did that every single day for like a full year. You know, she would bring me breakfast. She never embarrassed me. She just knew that I didn't have the money for food and for things. And then my friend and Elise would come in the evenings, and they would come through and bring me food. And then one of my two of my friends, Natasha and Laurie, would come in the weekends. So it was like this really interesting shift that the universe arranged between my friends. And that's the only time when I would get up. So I would get up because I knew Chacha was coming and she would bring breakfast, right? She would bring us food and she would like then make me sit at the kitchen table and she would make us food. She would have us chant and then up until like 12 p.m. she would then leave. So she'll come from 8 a.m. until 12 p.m., which was so nice.
Yeah.
And then from 4 p.m. onwards, my friend Annalise would come, and sometimes she'd come with a gentleman called Ras Eddie that we called our Rasta Dad. And they would come, and Annalise would literally make me sit. Like, actually, I haven't thought about this for years, but she'd make me sit at the dinner table and ask me, what do you want for your future? She would... And I realized that that was, it's like someone was dragging me out of the present to imagine a better future. So like I would just spend hours talking about what I would imagine, but I never thought it would happen, right? But I would talk, and I don't know, at some point I got up and I started running, and then I started running marathons and half marathons. But I still struggled to get out of bed, but I had these people that were helping me.
Yeah.
And in the process, like, my friends would also bring me so many self-help books. It was so annoying at times. So I tried all of the affirmations. We're like, okay, nope, she's getting worse. Nope, no more affirmations for you. Visualizations, oh no, she's getting worse. And nothing really clicked for me until another friend suggested that I go to a meditation retreat.
Okay.
She was like, you know, tried so many things. There's one thing that worked for me. Maybe go to Vipassana and go to a 10-day meditation retreat and just follow all the rules.
Okay.
Just don't talk. You take a vow of silence, so you're not allowed to talk. You're not allowed to read and write and all that. And some people try to break the rules. I just went there. And till this day, I've done like 11, 10-day sits. I take my vow of silence and I meditate for like 13, 14 hours a day.
I would go insane. No talking. No writing. No reading.
No anything. You don't chant. You don't do anything. It's just you and yourself, you know, and getting to understand your own soul. And that's the thing. You're not, when you write, when you read, you bring other people's thoughts into that, and then you create stories. But when you have all this free space where you don't do anything, that's when my shift happened. I walked out of there. I walked in suicidal, right? I wanted to take my own life because, and this is for someone listening in who maybe is in the situation like I was in, where, you know, when you try everything for me, where you like, you're trying, you're doing everything that people are telling you to do, and you've gone to do the MBA. You're doing the interviews. You're just running yourself ragged and nothing is shifting. That was me. So the only answer I could think of when my friend, before my friend even suggested the meditation retreat, was like, let me just end this. Let me end it, because what is the point? You're trying other people. And then, of course, I just graduated from the MBA program. A lot of my classmates are getting offers to be VPs, to be executives, to be all this. And they have starting offers of $200,000, $100,000 per year in salaries. And they're getting sign-up bonuses. Me, nothing. Crickets, this debt, nothing. And I just thought, Bandla. You know, like, I can just end it now. I should just end it now. So that's where I was. So when I went there and I started dealing with myself, the first thing that I noticed by day six, because one thing about Vipassana is it's non-sectarian, which means that it has no religious affiliation.
Oh, okay.
You don't meditate on a particular deity or anything. It's just anyone. That's why it's all over the world. They have centers all over the world. They free in all countries because it's non-sectarian. So regardless of the country, it doesn't cause problems. So you go there, you just sit with yourself. So by day six, I'm like, oh my God, I end up throwing up bile or acid, right? And I have this realization, why am I throwing up? Because all I can think about is money and worry about money.
Literally.
Now, literally, but I'm at the past now. So something is like saying to me, this doesn't add up, sis, because you are in a place where you're not required to pay. You're not required to worry about food. You're not required to worry about accommodation. They give you accommodation, they give you bedding, they give you everything. Your job is to just sit with yourself. However, you are constantly worried about money. You can't even for these 6 days, still have another 4 days to go,
Yo.
like even be still, because all I could think about was money. It was like by the time, because you're just sitting with your thoughts for 14 hours. You're observing yourself and your behavioral patterns of the mind and of the body. As it's like every day of my life, there's no space. I had that realization. There's no space for anything else in my mind. It's just about money, how I don't have money, worry over money. And it was driving me crazy. So I had that realization. And then day eight, something happens. Like I
Okay.
wake up in the morning because we
Yeah.
wake up at 4 a.m. to start the meditation.
Kodwa
So,
yini?
at 4 a.m., I wake up, and in Boston, in South Africa, we don't have the cell, but in Boston, the center has a cell, which means that, like, they put you in a little cell. Basically, it's almost like you
Robben
just have a
Island.
little, yeah, you have a little door, and it's just a cell enough for you to sit in. It's just dead silence. So there's no windows, no anything. You are just in the cell. So it's like four walls, basically. I mean, you've got the door, but it's four walls and a meditation cushion, and you sit there. So the teachers had suggested by day five that I start going to the cells to meditate, which helped my meditation practice because then you have absolutely no disturbance. It's not like when you're in a hall with other students. So sitting in the cell, I get this sense of intense peace. I had never felt anything like it. And the best way to explain it is to just say it was a sense of utter acceptance that this is my life, this is my situation, this is where I'm at. It wasn't joy, it was something so much deeper and more profound. And it stayed with me for the remaining for day eight, day nine, day 10. And then I thought it would leave when I left the center. And of course, I don't have that intense peace anymore, but it has never left me. It's become like this underlying part of my life. As in, like, no matter how bad things get, I cry, I get sad, but I don't get depressed. I don't stay in bed the whole day. And I've had, like, as an entrepreneur, and now as a full-time entrepreneur, I've had some really intense things happen in my life. I've had legal things, I've had like all sorts of craziness, I've had public shamings, I've had like all sorts of things that come with entrepreneurship and when you're in the public eye. But like, I just go about my life like, okay, that's just part of the deal, part of life. Things no longer break me like that. And I've just been able to just keep that peace. And I can't explain it to anybody. It's just, it's not what it was when it first arrived, but it is there. It was just that sense of all is well. That's the best way to explain it. It's just all is well. And I've never gotten depressed, touch wood. I always say, like, haven't had that kind of depression since. I walked out of the 10 days and I was like completely different. And because I had stopped creating stories around what it means to be in debt and without money, it then gave me the courage to do something I'd never done ever in my life before, which was look at my bank account and tally up every single bit of debt that I had. Write it down on a piece of paper, look at it, and strategically start working towards paying it. Something that even with my finance degree and with my MBA, I never had.
You know, so much of the things you said arose or brought up a lot of questions. And I'm just going to touch on two, but it's one question, right? So the first thing you said was your friend would come over and for about 4 hours, 3, 4 hours, you guys would do what you call a chant, right?
Yes.
And another friend suggested, hey, go and do this meditation thing for 10 days. And
Yeah.
you were telling me the story in relation to the question of how that despair became your turning point. And as I'm listening to
Yes.
you right now, I'm realizing that the turning point for you wasn't when you were speaking. It was when you were listening.
Yeah, oh wow, that's so profound. Yes.
And I'm
Oh
wondering
wow.
how many of us are running ragged, like you said, and are hitting our head against the wall because we are doing so much talking and we're not still enough to listen. And perhaps
No,
that's where
I
our healing
completely agree.
begins.
Yes, it does. I don't think I would be here today, honestly, if I had not listened. Because I knew nothing about meditation, right? I didn't know where to start. But you know what was so interesting is that I was attempting the stillness. I would want to get still, but I didn't know where to start. And like, I knew something was missing, man. Like, I think I knew something. Had like I knew I had to go within and listen, but I didn't have the tools. And I think with that, how call it the divine, call it the universe, call it whatever, sends you people and the answers. And yeah, I think that you have to be willing to receive it.
A hundred
Because I think the
percent.
other thing that as I'm talking about this, is I was willing to receive help from my friends. I let people nurse me and nurture me and help me.
I love that so
You
much.
know, and that was such a powerful thing. I think that's one of the most beautiful things is that like I realized that I was able to receive that in those
That
moments.
is so good. And you know, because this is a Christian station, I am Christian as well. When I think about, is it Jeremiah chapter 1? No, it's Joshua. What am I saying? Joshua chapter 1. Was it chapter 5? Way! So much for being a Christian. So much for being a Christian. But when God gives Joshua the instruction to, I think it is chapter 1, when God gives Joshua the instruction of how he is going to succeed and how he's going to conquer and how he's going to make sure that the Israelites are in the land of promise, the thing he says to Joshua is, meditate on my word day and night. And now in the context of this conversation, I understand meditation to be so different. And when it says meditate on the word, there's so much in the word. Prayer can also be meditation. I think, and I know with myself as well, whenever my head is flustered or I just need answers or strategies, I just kneel and I start talking to God. And in that moment, it's like an influx of ideas, an influx of peace, like you mentioned, come to mind. And perhaps that is the point of meditation, to be still enough to hear the things that you cannot hear otherwise when you're trying to hustle, or you're speaking to yourself, or you're speaking to others, or you're listening to other contributors. I think the beauty, and you know, at first when you said 10 days, no reading, no writing, no talking, I was like, I cannot do it. Because I even dream about the things I was thinking about during the day. And I wake up because in my dream, I have an idea that I have to write down before it goes away. I promise you, my mind is always, always racing. And I was just like, I was already getting frustrated and I'm not even there. Like, where do the ideas go? Where does all of this go? Woo! I don't know. But I wanted to move to,
Can I tell you that's the best thing about Vipassana. People, especially creatives and people like that, they're like, oh my God, I need to write it down. I need to do all these things. Like my ex-brother-in-law, Tebang Ramoba, goes to Vipassana and he says that he hears music and people always complain because then he starts playing his drums. He's the drummer in the Black Jacks, right? So he's playing his drums and like he creates sticks and he starts drumming on the steps because obviously in that silence so much comes through. But I have learned as someone who's a writer, right? And I write books. It's like the only way, like people are always like, Van, you've got so much content. Like when you go on my blog, people are like, you have 600 articles, you have reels, you've got live videos, you've got podcasts. And I'm just like, the content comes, because in those 10 days, what often happens with a lot of us, I'm so glad we're having this conversation, is that most of us tend to birth an idea before it is ready to come to the world. Right?
Oh.
And so what we do is, as soon as the idea comes, what do we want to do? Especially on that day one when we're like, it's popping. And then by day eight, obviously things are just coming, because you don't have the distractions. So your soul is just feeding you things. So people just rush and they want to write all that down and implement. But what Vipassana has taught me is that not all ideas are meant to be instantly implemented, and that you can actually sit with an idea and let it be pregnant with ideas, be pregnant with the concept, with an idea, and then implement, because in that way you will implement so much more. Like, most people don't know this, but the Eckhart Tolle is a Vipassana meditator. He wrote A New Earth, right? Daniel Goleman, who wrote, who gave us Emotional Intelligence, is a Vipassana meditator. So, and they also have those where they talk about sitting with ideas and being still and all that. And that comes from Vipassana, because most of us are implementing, and because there's so many ideas are going to come up for you, because you've got 10 days of stillness. Not everyone has to be implemented, and sometimes the ideas are interconnected, you know? And you need to give yourself time to be still, to sit, to strategize. And I think Vipassana has actually made me a better entrepreneur and a better writer because of that.
Vangile, how do we create this experience at home, or do we have to, is it mandatory for us to actually go into the environment that facilitates this kind of meditation? Or can we just have it at home and be intentional about creating it in order to create from a better place and to come to terms and be at peace with what is happening enough for us to be able to change it?
That's such a good question. I mean, some people are naturally those kinds of people, so they may not need a Vipassana center.
Not me.
Right?
Hey.
not me either, by the way.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So the best thing is to go to a center like that, or to go to a retreat. Remember, there are retreats like this. They offer journaling, they offer whatever, so you can go there. But if you are that person that lives alone and loved COVID and you could do this all day, every day, you can just have a timer. And there's no reason why it has to be 14 hours like they do at Vipassana, right? You can start slow. Like, I have a friend, she's also a Vipassana meditator. She lives in Angola. And she says she started off for an hour. And we used to do meditations over WhatsApp together to say, we're starting now, let's do. But now she no longer does it with me, because she says she just sits without a timer anymore. And if it takes the whole day, she will sit in meditation the whole day. You know, so I also think these things are up to a soul. Like, I am so not there yet, by the way, guys. I can't do it at home like that. Like, so she had to basically leave me behind, because I'm just not yet there. I still love my distraction.
And maybe for the benefit of somebody who's really listening to this and thinking, I have to give it a try, even if it's just 1 hour a day. What is the secret, or what is the art, and perhaps even the science of good meditation? And I'll tell you why I ask this, because I can be one of two ways. I'm either going, and sometimes I don't even feel tired because I just need to go. But then I can be a person who, if I just, even if I tilt or I slant a little bit, I'm gone, sleeping. And perhaps it's because I've gone, and my body is tired. So when I think about meditation, I'm thinking, let me just sit in silence with my eyes closed. Chances are I'm going to fall asleep. Or if I don't fall asleep, chances are my mind is going to be racing so much, and so much is going to be coming through and in and whatever in my mind that I will be tempted to break the meditation and write something down because I don't want to forget. So what is really the art and science of meditation? Is it warding away these ideas or these thoughts, or is the point to package them somehow such that when you come out of that meditative state, you're able to maybe articulate them better or incubate them? What is the point, and what is the best way to meditate that will not leave somebody feeling like they are failing at something as simple as just sitting in silence and with your thoughts?
Okay.
And so it's not simple, by the way.
Meditation. Yeah, there's something called Anapana meditation. There's different types of meditation. Mm. So Vipassana uses Vipassana and Anapana meditation. Mm. So Anapana meditation is really the best, especially just in general, even for Vipassana meditators, which is you observe your breath. Mm. And the way that I meditate, which has been a game changer, mm. I used to think that you need to clear your mind, yeah. clear that. Vipassana says that you just can't. Mm. There's no, like, stilling your mind mm. is like, what do they call it? They say it's like wrestling a beast, wrestling a wildebeest, or like an elephant, mm. wrestling an elephant, you mm. know, because the mind has a million thoughts a minute. So what you want to do in meditation is you want to use meditation as a form of self-discovery. Mm. So you observe your thoughts. I mean, you observe your thoughts. You focus on your breath. And as you focus on your breath, you're learning to just feel the sensations, observe your breath. So nothing but breath. You don't recite anything. You don't chant anything. You don't say in, out, one, two, three, four. No. You are focusing on the breath, training your mind to just focus on something, which is your breath, right?
Yeah.
And you're observing your thoughts. You're observing your mind. And then you're starting to be like, wow, this is the kind of stuff that my mind thinks about. That's how I realized on day six that all my mind thinks about is money. You know, this cannot possibly be healthy. There's there is literally no room for anything. So the aim is to just focus on that. And then you also start to see, wow, my mind has these kinds of thoughts. No judgment. It's not like maybe your mind is constantly judging other people. Maybe your mind is obsessing over a man. Like, I know a lot of women go to Vipassana and they end up like really like, wow, by day eight or day nine, they like, all I could think about was this particular boyfriend. Yo. That's all my mind was thinking about.
Yeah.
And the whole point is that your mind starts to notice itself and start and will course correct, because it will be like, what the F? All I do is think about this man, you know, just like all I do is think about money. No. So over time, your mind will start to still itself, but you have to, it's almost like you're showing your mind its habit patterns. So the whole point of meditation is to discover the habit pattern of the mind, not try to change it, not try to judge it, but just through allowing your mind to see itself and for you to see yourself.
Yeah.
You will start to make those changes, because as a person, you will decide, I like this, I don't like this. Maybe let's try something else. And it's not to judge yourself. It's not to force yourself to still your mind. So if your mind has a million thoughts a minute, let it have a million thoughts a minute. Learn to be comfortable in the discomfort of a mind that is racing.
You mentioned, is the word habit tracking?
Yeah, it's the what do they call it? The habit pattern.
The habit
the
pattern. And what does that then reveal about a person? For example, the person who was saying, 8 days I was thinking about this particular man. What does that reveal about that person? And what does that information, because for me it sounds like data, and I am a scientist, I am an engineer, so I think in terms of patterns. When you said pattern, I was thinking data. But with data we make decisions. So what then do we do with that data? Can we?
You don't do anything. You allow your mind to self-correct.
Oh.
Do you trust that your mind is so powerful that it can see that, no, this is not the right path for me? You know, like a lot of people are like, what did you do to stop the worries and anxiety about money? I'm like, I just allowed my mind to see itself. And it realized that thinking about money on a daily basis is not serving it or me.
I mean, you threw up. It's like the body was communicating what the mind was saying.
Exactly. So it's almost like in the trauma work that I do, right? And Vipassana informed the work that I do, which is that we do not fight and negate what is coming up. So when a person is panicking about money or stressed about money, I will not come and tell you to do affirmations and visualization and be grateful and all of that. Why? Because the minute you do that, your inner child, your inner teen, and even your subconscious mind feels gaslit.
Yeah.
Because, wow, I'm having this experience and you're trying to gaslight me. So what I have found with the work on trauma, and all therapists can back me up on this, is that you allow people to feel the full emotion, to go through the full talking and to feel it in the body, to feel everything that is happening. That way the body can actually integrate it and process it. And once it has integrated and it has processed, it can actually move on. Because what trauma is basically the inability to integrate an event that you have experienced. It's an event that is too overwhelming to process or integrate.
Yes.
So now when you allow yourself to just be in that moment, this is why for some people, an event, they can go to therapy for years and they can never really move past. Because talk therapy isn't, you're talking. And sometimes what needs to happen is to be still for the mind and the body to connect what has happened, right? This is why you're hearing like so many breakthroughs around yoga and meditation, because these are modalities that go into the body, right? Just being still, even if you're not doing really hectic forms of meditation, just like I said, with just the breath alone, we're not reciting anything, we're not doing anything, we're just observing the breath. It's, you're giving your mind that opportunity to just start to integrate things. It's the same thing as when people go on a water fast, right? And they say, oh, wow, it heals the body. Why? Because the body gets a break and then it gets to just self-correct. We're not sure what's really happening, but it just gets that rest to self-correct. So it's the same with the mind. But what often happens with most of us, we're carrying this trauma and then we're reading, we're doing all these things. So the mind doesn't get a break to go back into the trauma to then go through the full experience and come to a conclusion and see the truth of it and be like, oh, wow, yes, I'm stuck in this trauma of bullying. But did you notice that? Because when I started doing that and I was bullied at school, right, like I would start to say, wait, did you notice what the bully was going through in that moment? Like your mind has so many things that it's picking up, and then it starts to process, oh, of course that's why she reacted like that. It wasn't me. This is not my story. I can release it, and then it releases it.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm realizing therapy, breath work, and these retreats that you speak of, they treat the cause and not the symptom. And perhaps that is why mainstream money advice fails without the emotional healing.
Exactly. I've been saying this for a long time, right? Like, it really does. Because the issue, I mean, honestly, guys, we can teach budgeting in 5 minutes.
We can.
Like, there's no trick to budgeting. It's your income, less expenses, write down all your expenses, how much you earn, save what you get, save 10% of what you are receiving and getting. It's done.
Yeah.
Come on now. Yeah. This should be an easy thing. But why is it not easy? You know, what is happening? Because it's all the other emotional things that are coming up, our triggers. We walk into a store. You hear people say, I walked into a store and I lost myself. That's a very literal thing. Like I walked into Gucci and everything just left my mind. I lost myself. Why? Because they got hijacked by the inner teen who's all about fashion.
Sure.
You know, that part of them came to the fore, is all about fashion, wants to fit in or doesn't have and feels really scared of being rejected by the crowd. Adult you took a backseat, you know? So you really did lose yourself. So, I mean, I have clients that come to me and are saying, like, I literally had money and 5 days later, I don't know what I did with it. My bank account is empty. Yes, I understand. You were hijacked. Adult you took a backseat. Let's bring the part of you that hijacked you and heal it so that they can stop doing that.
It's starting to sound like there's a heavy, heavy need of boundaries. And you know, when we talk about boundaries, we are always talking about other people and ourselves.
Yeah.
They can't say that to me. They can't do that to me. They can't come this close to me or pass a certain line. When you're talking about our younger selves hijacking our older selves, such that our older selves are not making decisions in that moment, it sounds like there's a need for us to, at least in this moment, have a conversation about boundaries. And perhaps maybe boundaries is a secondary thing, because what that child needs is healing. But because we are going to be doing the work through these conversations and through working with you to do the healing, the next thing will be boundaries. How do we enforce boundaries with our younger selves such that the healing of that younger self can be facilitated? Because at least if I can say no right now, there will be a consciousness and that younger self to be like, no, so we're not doing this. Okay, what can we do? And maybe we can start the conversation and the work of healing. But talk to me about boundaries between that part of our lives or our minds or ourselves that is now hijacking this part that knows to do the right things, that knows all the financial education, but just panics and I guess becomes passive when the time to do those things comes.
Oh, I love this question. So boundaries with our younger selves, actually, it's not what people think I'm going to say. Yeah. You love your younger self through it all.
Yeah.
You invite them, you close your eyes, you invite them to come to the table, let them sit on your lap, and you hold them and you hug them and you just give them so much love.
Mm.
You know? You let them feel, you tell them that it's okay that they're scared.
Mm.
You tell them that it's okay that you're scared, but you don't have to protect yourself. I've got this now.
Mm.
You don't have to protect us. I have got this now. Adult me has got this now. So, but you, that requires building a relationship of trust.
Yeah.
Constantly hugging your inner child, constantly holding your inner child. Honestly, that was one of the most transformative things for me.
Mm.
Honestly, you know, because the first time I met my inner child, I tell people, like, I slapped my inner child because I was like, why won't you listen to me?
Mm.
Why won't you just do what I said? And like, my inner child would just continue to just like be resistant until I realized that actually, let me just listen to this child. Mm. Let me just hold them, hug them, and just hear them out, you know? So it's, and it runs really, really deep. Most of us have not had gentle parenting. So our thing is we want to parent our inner child and our inner teen the way that we were parented. And that's exactly what scarred us, right?
Yes, yes.
So we have to be gentle. And even when your inner child is like, I refuse to stop showing up and spending all this money and hijacking you. Your job is to say, can I hold you? Can I hug you? Tell me why you're refusing. And having a proper conversation like you would with your own children, but with lots of love, you know, and then just hearing them out and saying, yes, I hear you.
Yeah.
So how can I make you feel better? How can I give you the sense of safety even when there is money in the bank account,
you know? You know, I grew up in the church, right? And I can tell you now that there might be people listening to this conversation who are disengaging right now because a lot of this sounds new agey and Eckhart Tolle, like you said, you know, manifestation, universe and all of that. And I don't want to, while I'm very open-minded, and this is the invitation that I make to everybody, to be open-minded, because I don't think there's anything false about what you're saying and what you're teaching. I think it's very, very important. And perhaps that's why it's easy for Christians to be gaslit and for us to spiritually bypass ourselves, because we aren't engaging with things that could actually help us to become wholesome people holistically. And the reason I'm mentioning this is not to dissuade you from what you're saying, but to invite the people who might be feeling like, oh, this is very new age, I'm not going to do this. Where in the Bible can you prove that all of this? And the Bible really talks to us about renewing our mind. Capturing or keeping the thoughts captive that seek to bring us down. And I think when we read those verses, we don't really engage with what that could mean for us and what it looks like practically. And then we come into this conversation and we hear things like these and we want to reject them, not realizing that, hey, this is actually a link to the thing you read anyway all the time. So in this moment, I'm inviting you to invite the people who you've, and you probably dealt with so many of these people online and even in your practice that will completely disengage, because what they're saying sounds, what you're saying sounds like nothing they've heard before. Mm-hmm. And perhaps even hearing it is uncomfortable, because what do you mean I need to sit down with myself and my younger self at that? So please just open this platform, and I don't know what you're going to say, what language you're going to use to invite those who may have disengaged from this conversation.
No, I want to say to people, maybe you don't hear me, but maybe read your books, right? Go and read what Carl Jung said. He's one of the fathers of psychology, and he was very esoteric. I know that, right?
Yes.
But read psychology books. Read, if you go to a therapist, the therapist is going to ask you about your childhood, and most therapists are going to regress you into a childhood and do inner child meditations with you and do inner teen meditations with you. There is, for healing to happen, you cannot escape this. So regardless if you go to therapy, if you listen to me, these are the modalities that you're going to be asked to look at. Write letters to your inner child. Because, I mean, these are the, if you've tried everything and you're like, it's just not working, you can't ignore your childhood. It shapes you. You can't ignore your parents' childhood. It's something that you carry in your DNA.
Yes.
So you have to sit down and talk to your parents and ask them, how was your upbringing? How do you think your upbringing has impacted the way you parented me? And you have to reparent yourself, because chances are you're going to just do exactly like how I said. I was beaten as a child, right? So the first thing I did with my inner child was to beat my inner child, not knowing.
Yeah.
It came from just not knowing, because I was doing this on my own without a therapist, without anything, because remember, I didn't have money, so I didn't know where to start. But over time, I read books, I did my research, and even though I didn't have the money, I started developing my own meditations to help me. And I learned that the only way for the shift to happen is through love and the gentle parenting and reparenting myself. And then I started doing that, and that's when I saw the shifts in my life. So maybe you don't believe in this, but give it a month. See what happens when you do something like this. Invite your inner child, hug them. You don't even have to talk. The first few times, I just said sorry to my inner child, and I just hugged her, and we cried and cried and cried. And I did that for like days on end, like every single night I would do this. And then I started to notice that, no man, a shift is happening in my life. This thing is very, very real. How I'm approaching people in my life is also different. I mean, so many people have said to me, you're just different now. You know, you're calmer. I used to be one of those people, like hair trigger, temper, just like all of those things. I'm very impatient. I make decisions so quickly.
Yeah.
And it showed up in my finances, right? Like impulsive. Like I could not see a thing in a shop and then go and decide to sit with it and feel what that feels like in my body. You know, I couldn't do a lot of these things, but like over time, I become a person who has been able to sit calmly, to hear people out, to do things. And it's like, it's no skin off my back to be able to change my character, but, and to change certain things that were not serving me. But in so doing, I have transformed my life in radical, radical ways. You know, like I was saying to some clients yesterday, like I could never have imagined myself married as a person, you know, because I was just like, what the hell? I'd have to deal with another person. Not only just married, but chilled about it and being able to just sit with my husband and be like, oh, okay, here's a thing, all that. And just, you know, but that comes from healing. Like, yes, if I hadn't healed, nothing would have changed. And I didn't change for someone else. I changed because I realized that some, what I thought were personality traits were just trauma, was just trauma. It wasn't a personality trait. I can be as patient as the next person, you know?
So I'm just saying because somebody gave you my journal and you've been reading it and you came here armed. armed to expose me to people. You know, as you're talking now about our parents' history and our DNA, I'm a workaholic. And I've never said that before. But I'm realizing now that I'm a workaholic. And for the longest time, I think because I don't like domestic work. Like I'm not domesticated, and it's not because my mom didn't do the work of domesticating me, but I just don't gravitate towards that kind of work, right? But when it comes to work, I am a workaholic, and I'm thinking now, I seldom saw my mom when I was younger. I saw my mom on the weekends because it was church and Sunday and whatever. But my mom would leave before the sun came up and would come back long after it's come down. Well, for her, it was circumstantial. I mean, she was using public transport, trains, and she was working far from home, as is the case with a lot of families and parents in Soweto. But to this day, my mom can't sit down. My mom is old. She's 66. My mom cannot sit down. If she's not doing housework, she's doing church work. She's not doing church work, she's doing her business. My mom cannot sit down.
Yeah, and that's I'm just black like, women, though. I talk a lot about that.
My mind does not sit down. I told you that 10 days. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. You're trying to kill me. 10 days of, and a lot of my work is mental, right? I run a consultancy and I service clients. I'm developing frameworks and blueprints and lectures and all of that. My mind is always working. And I don't think that's healthy. If I sat there, my brain would tell me, girl, no.
No, that's very, very true. In Vipassana, it's called stillness of body and mind. So you're not allowed to exercise. You're not allowed to do yoga. You're not allowed to do anything. You are still, stillness of body and mind. And you will start to realize that the mind and the body are interconnected.
Yeah.
Most black women don't sit down because of trauma.
Yes.
You have to keep moving because it's like stillness requires a sense of safety. For you to actually be completely still, you have to be safe. One thing my sister just did of a Vipassana sit, she did a few, when? 2 weeks ago, she came out. And then we were talking to a friend of hers that we were dropping off at Vipassana. And this friend had been saying that she was just obsessing about this guy throughout Vipassana and everything. Because my sister was saying to her, wow, you look like you were going through things. Hey? You were crying, all that. And then she was having that realization that sometimes comes up that, wow, I'm just obsessing about one human being and it's not healthy for me, you know. So she was sharing that. And then she was like, and my sister asked her, why were you obsessing about him? And she said, because he's the only person that has ever made me feel safe, right? And my sister said, no, he's not. That's perceived safety. And this has changed my life forever. And I think it's going to change all of you guys' lives. My sister said something interesting. She's like, if you're in a relationship and you feel safe, you don't even think or obsess about your partner. Because what they're doing is of no... You just know that they, whatever they're doing is for your good. So you don't, you think about them as in like, oh, wow, I wonder what my person is doing, my husband, my boyfriend. But you don't obsess, oh, my God, I need to get him on the phone every single minute. I need to know what he's doing. I need to understand where he's at, all of that. You know, you don't try to control where he's at. You're not having, you know. You're not trying to hold on to it. Why? Because it feels safe. And safety by its very nature is relaxation. It's stillness. It is a still spirit. And I just sat there gobsmacked. I was like, what? So when she said that, I was like, that is so, so fascinating because it made me remember when I was anxious and worried all the time about money. I obsessed about it all the time. Right. And now I can go the whole day and just open up my bank account the end of the day and in the morning to just look what's going on and move on. Right. It's not avoidance. But a true safety is that you're not avoiding the thing, but you're also not obsessing about it. And you're able to just be still and relaxed. And I thought that was so phenomenal. Right. So a lot of us are in a state of hypervigilance, and so we don't know why we cannot be still. It's always this, and we're reacting from survival mode, that if I am still, then my needs won't be taken care of. So I am not, right? But like one of my favorite verses or songs from the Bible, and I repeat it often to myself, is just be still, know that I am God. You know, because I think that, and it's so funny because that song, by the way, before I went to Vipassana, was constantly playing in my head on a loop on the days when I was going through everything that I was going through with my panic attacks and everything. But I never knew how to interpret it because I didn't know what that looked like be still. So whenever I hear it, I now know that, okay, I can be still and go into meditation. Right?
Yeah.
And that's coming from someone who is not a deep Christian, you guys, or any of that. But like that, I got so much from those words. And it's still till this day one of my favorite songs.
And, you know, honestly, for somebody who isn't deeply spiritual or religious by any stretch of imagination, you sure are bringing so much light into scripture. And, you know, in this moment, it's not so much what your sister said, but I guess what you just revealed to me. The thing that gobsmacks me right now is this. The areas we are holding on to control in could reveal the areas we feel most unsafe in.
Oh, wow. Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
That's why that verse then, be still and know that I am God, it means in every other area where you are still and you're not moving around and running around and don't feel the need to control, it's because you believe that God's got it. But in the area you don't, it's like, I'm not going to be still. I'm going to hustle. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And I think the challenge for me right now and the challenge I'm throwing to everybody is, especially for those A-type personality people, oh, I love control, da-da-da-da. And whether you're firstborn or your parents or whatever it is, or you're a workaholic like I just claimed to be, could it be that you are so much in control because that is the area you feel the least safe in? And for me, it's work. And I'm secure in my talent and my skill. I know that what I have to offer the world is magnificent. The work I do changes lives. I'm secure in that knowledge. But and now I need to do the work of thinking, then what are you insecure in? If you're working so much, what is the element of unsafety that you feel around this?
Oh, that's deep. That is so deep. Okay, you just dropped a truth bomb right there. Wow, but that does make sense, you know, because sticking with the area of relationships, since that's what we were talking about with my sister, I noticed that because she also reminded me, she was like, remember when you were like dating, you would be like with certain people, you'd be like all over the place. And then when I met my husband, it was just like whatever. The sense of deep safety, and people say that like that you co-regulate to another person's nervous system, right? And you can feel their nervous system. So, and like, it's so funny because a lot of my friends always say like his nervous system has got this deep stillness around it, that being in a space that you just feel still because he is that kind of person. And I instantly felt that, and I just felt so, so safe. And I didn't do any of that extra hot mess that, you know, as women we can do, you know, just doing the very, very most.
Yeah.
And so, and as a result, it allowed me to just unfold and be me, you know. And I think that's so, so interesting and so, so powerful what you've just said about like your control and the unsafety. Because when you try to, oh my gosh, when I was trying to control the narrative in the past in relationships, it was a hot ghetto mess. Like, I mean, really, really hot mess.
Yeah.
And so when I started to feel safe within myself, I could also recognize another nervous system that feels safe. And also the more I've been able to notice what safety feels like for me, even in environments at work or anything in travel, I could start to notice this doesn't feel safe for me and I should walk away from this. You know, I didn't try to alter it. I allowed it. So even if work when mm-hmm. opportunities don't feel right in my system. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it looks like I'm a crazy person because yeah. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do this, because I've learned through trial and through huge disappointments mm-hmm. that like it's important for my nervous system to feel at peace and safe mm-hmm. because when it feels like that, so much more happens with a small opportunity than yeah. with a big opportunity. Yeah. But I am just like not feeling safe at all.
And just as we wrap up, because I'm looking at the time right now, is safety a destination you arrive to, or something you work towards, something that you can build into whatever it is you have going on or who you are? And I'm thinking, for example, perhaps, I will be thinking about this quite intently now that we've had this conversation, but for me, perhaps the reason why I'm not necessarily still in my mind where work is concerned is because I've just gotten back to it, right? So it's a month back into business, and so yeah. I'm setting up systems. There are things that need to run. I'm having conversations with suppliers and all of those things in order mm-hmm. for things to stabilize. And once those systems are set up, then I can begin to relax. So could it be yep. that safety isn't something that you have to just arrive at, but something that you literally have to arrive at, meaning there is a journey that brings you to a point of safety?
I do think, yeah, I don't think anything is cut and dry. This is what safety is. I do think it is a journey. Mm. And I do think it's a continuous journey,
yeah.
right? Sometimes you will get completely, you know, all over the place. Mm. And I think that's good. It's important. So I want people to take away from this that actually one of the key things to remember is that just because your thoughts are racing doesn't mean that you're not feeling safe. Just because you're working like a crazy person doesn't mean that you're not in a sense of safety in that area in your life. It may be that the season calls for that.
Yeah.
It would be crazy not to always be calm in this world.
Then you're not
human. You're not human.
Yes.
And actually, a regulated nervous system is not one that is always calm.
Oh, I love
that. That is a dissociated nervous system. So when people come to me and tell me that I'm always calm, I don't get worked up. Now I'm like all over the place. I'm like, you were dissociated. Now it's no longer working for you. Now you're starting to feel things. That's why you're going all over the place. You weren't really calm. You weren't really sweet. You were just someone that was just not in their bodies and feeling their emotions. But a nervous system that is truly regulated and safe is a nervous system that can have like its highs and deep lows and yet come back to center, right? It's like so safety would be you can work for 3 months and then you realize that, wait, my body needs a rest. And then you instantly take that rest for like a month, 2 months. You can go back and then you find a balance, but then something happens. More is required of you. You come back to balance. And sometimes you are so lazy, you're resting. You take that break. You rest for longer periods. You come back up. That is life, right? Ultimately, what we want is that you're more in the balance and you're not going to high extremes and staying at the extremes. That you're not working like you're working now for like a year, 2 years, but 3, 4 months, 5 months, yeah. And then you're coming back to rest, and like you're finding some balance. And then again, things happen. And then sometimes you find that, oh, I'm so lazy. I just need time off, all that. That is called being human. But if you stay elevated at that place of overwork, that's when we all know now from doctors in recent decades that it leads to burnout. It literally leads to death. People are dying from
insanity
overwork,
too.
Right? So we know that it's not healthy, but it's okay if it's for like a few months. I mean, beyond like 3, 4 months, that's when like therapists and doctors would then become concerned because you're risking your health, you know? So that's like one of the big things. So that's one thing that I want people to realize that like life has seasons.
Yes.
You will go to extremes. A regulated nervous system is one that doesn't stay in the extreme. You know, so it's okay to feel anxious.
Yeah.
It's okay to feel angry and to be elevated in that. But if you are anxious for like weeks on end, then we have a problem. emotional states are supposed, you're supposed to go in and out of emotional states, right? And then go back to other states of emotion. You're supposed to go to joy and feel that and go back to anger and sadness and all that. You're not meant to stay there.
Oh, what a conversation. What a conversation. And it's just reminding me, this is completely off topic, but we're wrapping up. I'm wrapping up the conversation. I remember when, so I used to have like really bad period pains, and the gynae put me on birth control pills. Oh, the best time of my life. I would not be angry. I would not be sad. I would not be I was just so lull. It was just, we were cruising nicely. And then I got off the pills because I wanted to see if they were actually helping, right? Because I would still feel some, I still feel some pains. And I was like, these pills are not helping. Then I got off the pills. Yeah. And all the emotions came back. Then I'd be angry. Then I'd be sad. Then I'd be happy. I'm just like, I don't like this. But you know what you've just said now is, it's not human to not feel. It's not human to experience those troughs and those peaks. That is, and there wouldn't be a need for regulation. And I think our nervous system serves exactly that purpose, to tell us when we're in danger, to tell us when things are great. It serves as a way for our minds and the rest of our bodies to know what is happening. When you're in danger, your nervous system will tell you to run. When you when there's joy, a marriage, a birthday party, a birth, your nervous system will tell you this is a good thing. Celebrate it, enjoy it. Yes. And so I also don't want anybody to walk away from this conversation feeling like because they are currently in a low and their minds are also tanking and their mental health is not doing great, that means it will never get better or they're doomed to that state. It will get better. This is part of the human experience also. If we were at the mountaintop the whole time, it wouldn't make sense. If we were at the bottom of the valley, it would also not make sense. But the reason we're able to appreciate the great things is because we know what it's like at the bottom. But also the reason why we're able to endure the bottom is because we know that it doesn't stay this way. We are going to trek up to the top. So the things we experience at the bottom give us the hope and the drive to keep pushing, because life is not stagnant. I think there's a song by Msaki and is it Sanel musician that says, "Boma bumanga," life continues, it keeps moving, it keeps going. And that is the beauty of it. You know, when I walked into this conversation, I was expecting us to talk about, so when you're feeling depressed, so what happens when you're anxious? This is not the mental health and finance connection conversation I thought we were going to have. But I think it's the conversation that we needed to have, not just for ourselves, but for everybody who's listening, because we can't talk mental health without healing. There is no mental health without healing. We just can't talk about it. And at this point, there was an invitation to look deeper into healing the thing about you that is bringing you so much disarray and so much discord, when finances are not working out. Because if you can heal that child or heal that part of you, then the conversation will not be, I'm in the bin, my mental health is taking a knock. No, you're just experiencing life. And I guess your mind is realizing that and making a note of that. But what do you do? And it starts with the healing. And for some, our healing will start with us being still and listening. Just keeping quiet and listening. Yes. And that is the gift you gave us in this conversation. Thank you very, very much.
I'm so glad. Thank you for having me, Mbumi. Honestly, you're like one of my best interviewers. Love it.
I love having you as well. Have a lovely rest of the week.
Thank you. You too.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Ah, what a conversation. What a conversation. I am Nompumelelo Mbonani, and I hope you have just made sense of your financial and mental health. Fresh mercies tomorrow. Ciao for now.
You are tuned into Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.